intelligence failures? Why not the policy failures? Perhaps, I figured, because politicians and policymakers had set the rules, and they constituted the entire commission. There were no incentives for policymakers to blame themselves. They were protecting their tribe. Not a single intelligence professional held one of the commission's seats. It was sort of like assembling a blue-ribbon commission to review a health care crisis without any doctors participating. Worse, the commission and the public held the CIA to a standard of unattainable tactical perfection in a context of strategic policy failure. The CIA had made mistakes, but there is nothing more imperfect in man's endeavors than espionage and war. Yet the CIA had provided strategic warning. AQ wanted to kill as many Americans as possible. Moreover, the enemy had repeatedly demonstrated its intent and capability. CIA intelligence said more terror was coming in a big way. Policymakers, however, had cashed in the Cold War victory dividend and then dispensed limited, parsed authorities and meager resources to the CIA. Granted, some CIA leaders, such as Pavitt, did not want more responsibility, but CTC leaders like Kofor railed about the threat and scrounged for the means to destroy the enemy long before 9/11. Rich badgered Kofor and me every day for more resources. Rich and his team had risked their lives flying in Massoud's relic helicopters because we had none of our own. I considered all these things and more as I looked at Zelico. The gap between us loomed large. The distance between a clandestine operative and an academic turned policy advisor. Despite this gulf of perspectives, I harbored no animosity toward Zelico or others on the commission. On the contrary, I respected them for their service, just not for all their conclusions. Zelico held the discussion in his office, just down the hall from that of the new Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. She had just moved from the National Security Advisor portfolio at the White House. She was putting together a new team, and Zelico was helping her. A professor with a brilliant analytical mind but lacking interpersonal skills, Zelico made some pleasant talk before we launched into a discussion of macro geopolitics. He could not help but be pedantic, even when he worked to be polite and generate rapport. He wanted my view, so I outlined some thoughts. The exchange was friendly. I appreciated Zelico's insights. I also noted his willingness to listen to my blunt criticism. In fact, I was flattered that he wanted my opinion. I noted that the U.S. approach to counterterrorism was too narrow and too conventional. I stressed several points. First, while the nation-state will remain the most important organizing principle in international affairs, non-state actors like Al-Qaeda are becoming more important. We must factor non-state actors, enemies, and allies into our strategic thinking. Their leadership is critical. We must be prepared to nullify or empower selected non-state leaders. We must map the human terrain. It is more than ever a part of the strategic landscape. This means more and better intelligence. Second, we must attack the enemy in their safe havens, from a policy perspective, not just in terms of intelligence collection or military operations. Ending enemy safe haven is a strategic objective. We must express our power, a mix of hard and soft, into these areas. And where do you find these safe havens? I asked rhetorically as I unfolded a map. Here, 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 and here. I pointed on the map to the Durand Line, Afghanistan-Pakistan, Kashmir, Pakistan-India, the Sulawesi Sea littoral, Malaysia, Philippines, Indonesia, the Sahel, and the Horn of Africa, including Yemen across the Red Sea, and pockets in the Levant, Lebanon-Syria, Lebanon-Israel, and Israel-Gaza. There were others, but these were at the top of my list. What do they all have in common? They are in border areas. Because of physical and political geography, the enemy finds refuge in these locations. AQ, Hezbollah, and their affiliates understand international boundaries, and they use them to their advantage. We still look at the world as a collection of nation-states, but the enemy is not organized that way. They don't fight that way, except to take advantage of our own bureaucratic restrictions. When, for example, have the ambassadors in South Asia, or any counterterrorism theater for that matter, convened to consider counterterrorism policy? To look at the region, not just their countries of responsibility? I asked rhetorically. I knew the answer. Never. What I outlined on the map was a repetition of what I had told Kofor in September 1999. The enemy safe havens had not changed, except for most of Afghanistan. Pakistan remained a major problem. Somalia and Yemen, in fact, were getting worse. In 1999, we had not focused on penetrating these areas for intelligence collection and covert action. In 2005, we had not yet organized ourselves to forge policies matching our strategic objectives. In fact, ending enemy safe haven was not even discussed as a strategic objective. It was not just a regional problem. We had to think, plan, and act on four policy levels: local, national, regional, and global. I did not yet know how to describe the disaster unfolding in Iraq, which seemed to be several conflicts laid on top of each other in the context of the U.S. war against AQ, so I skipped it. Third, we must harness all the instruments of statecraft. We talk about a holistic government approach, but we don't do it. We have no expeditionary power projection beyond the CIA and the military, so that's why they are doing all the heavy lifting. But once we secure these villages and valleys, then what? Where's the electricity, communications, health care, education, economic development, and the hope? Without that, we have no enduring victory. Our hard power buys space and time, but then what? We have not correctly defined our non-state enemies and allies. Our policy is insufficiently nuanced. We often lump Al-Qaeda together with all Islamism as a political ideology competing with our liberal democracy. They are not the same. We are not engaging the enemy in the right place, its safe havens. We are not integrating all of our statecraft tools. We are failing to define and reach these three strategic objectives. Otherwise, we're doing just great, I concluded. Zelikow nodded steadily and smiled, with lips pressed tightly together. "Let's talk some more," he said. "Sure. You know where to find me." I figured that was the end of our discussion. A couple of months later, he called again. We engaged in another discussion in his office. I heaped more criticism on our policies, including the fiasco in Iraq, where we sought to impose our conventional strategies on an unconventional war, or, more accurately, multiple unconventional conflicts layered upon each other. We were fighting an AQ terrorist campaign that depended on recruits from throughout the Middle East and had links to a local Sunni insurgency, as well as a Shia insurrection backed by Iran, a desperate and vicious network of former regime loyalists and bands of criminal gangs looting the country. With our invasion and occupation, we had humiliated the people of Iraq and angered our Arab allies throughout the region. After this second exchange, in which Zelikow encouraged the criticism, I figured he was looking for something specific from me. I soon heard from two friends that, on behalf of Secretary Rice, he was searching to fill the slot of coordinator for counterterrorism. I was the lead candidate. My boss and mentor, Kofor Black, had held the job under Secretary Powell. I immediately called him and sought his advice. I had not been offered the job, but I wanted to be prepared if Rice gave me the opportunity.
"Take it," Kofor barked. "Remember what I told you about the agency? Great place, but time to get out. Just make sure that you work directly for Rice, nobody else. Certainly don't work for Zelikow. Rice is your only source of power. That and your rank as ambassador at large is big juju. You will be the president's representative, and anywhere you go, anywhere in the world,
you will be received as his envoy. You will be his envoy. There are some downsides. State is a dysfunctional organization, weak security, horrible admin. Your staff is small and weak. Your budget sucks. Got it?
What about cover? There is no going back. I stated the obvious.
Of course not. There will be far more press, more public diplomacy than you can imagine. Prepare for it. It's important. Also, be prepared for how the CIA looks from the outside. It's different and not always flattering. The clandestine service is not the center of the universe.
I had a glimpse of the external perspective of the CIA while at SAIS a couple of years earlier. I wondered about the public diplomacy. I had not even considered that.
So, Kofor, this press thing. Weird, huh? I asked.
Yep, very, but you can handle it. Just remember that they can ask any question, but you can answer.